From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the words and music of Jelly Roll Morton. Actor and singer Vernell Bonnerys and pianist Morten Gunnar Larsen will perform excerpts of their new Jelly Roll Morton show. New Yorker jazz critic Whitney Balliot described the show as a subtle, funny, graceful, haunting portrait of Jelly Roll Morton. Also, we talk with SCTV alumna Catherine O'Hara. She's played the deranged Delia in Beetlejuice, the gossipy TV journalist in Heartburn, and the distraught mom in Home Alone. Now she's mom again in Home Alone 2. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews an ABC miniseries about the Jacksons. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President-elect Bill Clinton said today that he'll press ahead with his promise to overturn a ban on gay and lesbian members of the military. Clinton also outlined other plans in his first news conference since Election Day. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The president-elect said that he will reverse the long-standing ban on homosexuals in the military, but indicated today he will do it in a way that would ease its impact on the armed services, which favor keeping the ban in place.
The issue ought to be conduct. Has anybody done anything which would disqualify them, whether it's tailhook scandal or something else? And so what I plan to do in an appropriate fashion, in a prompt fashion, is to put together a group of people and let them advise me about how we might best do this.
Mr. Clinton also said he would reverse the so-called gag rule that prohibits federally funded family planning clinics from giving advice on abortion, and he announced he will issue rules tomorrow setting out acceptable conduct for members of his transition team, followed by rules for members of his administration. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
A new survey of American sex practices indicates that millions of people are risking infection by the AIDS virus. The survey, to be published in tomorrow's issue of Science magazine, claims to be the largest conducted in the United States in more than 40 years, and found that heterosexual Americans aren't taking the risk of AIDS seriously, and that the vast majority of people with multiple sex partners are not using condoms. An author of the study said the results indicate that it's just a matter of time before AIDS infection spreads widely into the heterosexual population. A tenuous ceasefire appears to be generally holding in Bosnia today, despite outbreaks of fighting in a few parts of the republic. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports from Belgrade.
In Sarajevo, a spokesman for the United Nations peacekeeping force said that by local standards of the meeting of ceasefire, the truce was generally holding, although he added that the UN troops were unable to monitor the entire territory. Bosnia's three warring factions, Serbs, Croats, and Muslims, exchanged charges of violating the ceasefire that went into effect at midnight last night. Sarajevo Radio reported that Serbs waged an offensive against Gradačac, the last Muslim-held town in northern Bosnia, and that fighting raged between Croats and Serbs in the southern city of Mostar. The ceasefire was signed Tuesday by the military commanders of the warring factions and follows many short-lived truces since war broke out in April. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Belgrade.
Stock prices were almost unchanged today on Wall Street after a session of mixed trading. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost less than a point to finish the day at 3,239.79. Advances edged out declines in heavy trading of about 225 million shares. This is NPR. At least four people were killed today in fighting in South Lebanon. United Nations peacekeepers were drawn into the fighting between the Israeli army and Hezbollah guerrillas. Authorities in Beirut said that a guerrilla and a Nepalese soldier attached to the UN were killed in a firefight after the UN soldiers refused guerrilla orders to abandon their surveillance position. Three other Nepalese soldiers were wounded. An Israeli soldier and a guerrilla were killed in a separate skirmish in the Israeli-occupied area along the Lebanese border. Israeli officials are back at the bargaining table in Ottawa for a conference on Palestinian refugees. They'd walked out yesterday, charging the head of the Palestinian delegation was connected to the Palestine Liberation Organization, with which Israel will not negotiate. Jennifer Ludden reports.
The Palestinian delegation is headed by Mohammed Halaj. He's the leader of the Palestinian National Council, which is the Palestinian parliament in exile. Yesterday, Israeli delegates claimed the council is controlled by the PLO. They left the conference and made plans to leave Ottawa. But this morning, officials announced a breakthrough. Israeli delegate Ruth Yaron said she'd been assured Halaj is currently not a member of the Palestinian National Council. The council meets irregularly. There can be months or even years between sessions, and Halaj last attended the PNC in 1991. Today is the last of a two-day session focusing on the plight of Palestinian refugees forced from their homes by the Arab-Israeli conflict. For National Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Ludden reporting.
Canada's Inuit people have approved a land claim settlement that will acknowledge their ownership of the world's largest private land holding. The agreement would establish an Inuit homeland called Nunavut on an area of the Canadian Arctic that's five times the size of California. A native political organization said today the agreement was approved by 69% of the people in the area. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In his own lifetime, Jelleroy Morton never received the recognition he deserved. Morton may not have invented jazz, as he claimed he did, but he's now acknowledged as the first great jazz composer. There are two shows about him now in New York, the Broadway hit Jelly's Last Jam and the cabaret show Jelleroy Morton, A Memorial. The creators of the cabaret show are joining us to perform excerpts. Actor and singer Vernell Bonnaries also created the revues One More Time, Furthermore, and Stagger Lee. He was the accordion player in the film Pennies from Heaven. Like Jelleroy Morton, he's from New Orleans. Pianist Morten Gunnar Larsen is from Norway. Their show was described as brilliant by New Yorker jazz critic Whitney Balliet. The narrative within the show is taken directly from Jelleroy Morton's oral history as recorded for the Library of Congress. Here's Vernell Bonnaries with Morten Gunnar Larsen at the piano.
Anytime you hear anybody playing jazz, what they playing is Jelleroy. Now, I never got the credit for it, or the cash for that matter, but believe me, it's Jelleroy. In foreign lands, across the sea, they knight a man for bravery. Make him a duke or a count, you see. Must be a member of the royalty. Mr. Jelly played a jazzy thing in the temple by the queen and king. All at once he struck upon a harmonic chord. The king said, make Mr. Jelly a lord. He's Mr. Jelly Lord, simply royal at the old keyboard. You should see him strolling down the street. The man's an angel with great big feet. With his melodies, they've made him Lord of the Ivories. Now at home, as well as abroad, they call him Mr. Jelly Lord. Now, you may be thinking that it might be a bit egotistical of me naming a song after myself. But really, now, anybody who was anybody in the city of New Orleans at that time, they had a song named after them. Usually for heroic reasons, people held high in the minds of their fellow citizens. Not all the time, though. Some people had songs named after them for quite a different reason. A perfect example is a guy I used to play pool with. I couldn't have been no more than 16, 17 years old at the time. Now, he had a song named after him because he was no doubt one of the most heartless men I have ever met. I didn't know it at the time, or else I never would have been playing pool with him. And I certainly would have never beat him at it. But he used to like to play pool with me because he knew that all the piano players at the different bordellos always had plenty cash money. And I was no exception. I'd walk up to the table, throw down my wad and say, okay, stand back with your little fives and tens and Give my 50s here a chance to breathe. That's what I would say, showing off in front of him. Little did I know that the man I was talking to was Aaron Harris. The man already had 11 killings to his name. Aaron Harris is a bad, bad man. Aaron Harris is a bad, bad man. Now he's the baddest man ever was on this land. I tell you, between people like Aaron Harris and Hoodoo and the racial prejudice that existed in New Orleans at that time, I found that I had to leave the city where I was born and raised and had truly come to love in my heart.
That's wonderful. And that's Vernell Bonnaris and Morten Gunnar Larsen at the piano. And this is an excerpt of the Jelly Roll Morton show that they're now performing at Michael's Pub in New York. And everything that you say in the show is from the Library of Congress recordings.
Yeah, they're all truly Jelly's words and Jelly's music as Jelly intended it to be heard.
Have you tried to get the inflection of his voice when you've been listening to the records?
I'm from New Orleans. I don't have to try that.
Well, you brought it up. You're from New Orleans, and like Jelly Roll Morton, you're a Creole, too.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, when you were growing up, were you listening to a lot of his music? Were your parents listening to a lot of his music?
Not my parents, but my grandmother. There was a generation skip there. My grandmother knew of Jelly Roll, and she was the one that told me the stories about the Lyric Theater, which led to One More Time, an evening at the Lyric Theater, 1926. So she had all of that vaudeville and gospel influence. My parents went more for Nat King Cole and Frank Sinatra and that sort of Americana that was moving into the culture at that point, thanks to television. But my grandmother held to her memories and shared them with me, and we had a lot of quiet moments together. I lost her last year. That's why I'm talking so sentimental about that. But it was a real treat.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Vernell Bonnaris, who is performing a Jelly Roll Morton review at Michael's Pub in New York. With us also is Morten Gunnar Larsen, the pianist with the show. And Morten, I'm going to ask you to do a piano solo. And I heard this while you were rehearsing, and it's quite amazing. So do you want to introduce it at all before you play it?
Yes, I may. It's piece that probably Morten composed rather late in his life after coming to New York City. He wanted to, really show him off as a brilliant piano player. And when he met the stride piano players in New York, like Fats Waller, Duke Ellington, James P. Johnson and others, he wanted to make a piece of a real technical virtuosity. He always thought of his own music as very melodic and saw that as quite superior to technical brilliance. But he needed to make this piece simply, I think also to make a bit of caricature of the stride piano tradition. So he called it simply the finger breaker.
I'm out of breath just listening to that. That's fantastic. That's Morten Gunnar Larsen at the piano, and he's performing in the Jelly Roll Morten Review at the Michael's Pub in New York. How did you learn that? Did you learn it from a written transcription or from listening to a record over and over again?
From both, actually. I started buying Morten's records rather early and just trying to play them by ear from what I heard he did. And it's a lot of it is improvised music, of course. But after a while, there came out some very good transcriptions done by Jim Dapogny, the collected piano works of Gerald Morten. So I got that in the early 80s, and it was really interesting study, I think.
When you started performing in America, were there a lot of Americans who found it strange that a Norwegian should be so proficient at ragtime, which is a form that grew up in America?
Yes, I found very many Americans find it very surprising, especially at that early time. So I always had to give that answer that it's really music that's been heard a lot in Europe.
Do a lot of Americans have the stereotype that if you're European, that you're going to play jazz in a very square way? Have you encountered that stereotype?
I have never encountered it from Americans saying it to me. But I'm sure, it's a cultural foundation in the music that you always have to, you have to study it a lot.
I've encountered it behind his back.
Have you?
It's possible.
Yeah, they do think that it's going to come out of a box and it's going to not contain a heart. And this summer, I spent the whole summer in different jazz festivals around Europe, and some of the musicians were just so wonderful in direct comparison to New Orleans musicians.
Morten, what is the difference that you hear between ragtime pianist and Jelly Roll Morten, who, although he wrote rags, I don't really think of him as a ragtime pianist?
No, definitely. He looked on himself as the first important jazz pianist, really. And there's a very important difference in that ragtime is composed music. When you think of the Scott Joplin rags, for instance, everything is written down, just like in European classical music. Whereas early jazz piano is improvised in a language that is a lot freer than ragtime. Morten used to love to demonstrate that difference with Joplin's Maple Leaf Rag.
Sure, do you want to do a little
demonstration? I can just show you very quickly. If you play it very strict the way Joplin wrote it, it has a almost baroque feeling, I call it sometimes, because it's very... precise like that, but Morten liked to slow the tempo down a little bit to give room to play with the different phrases a bit more and to leave in some blue notes, for instance, and also square out the rhythm a little bit so it would sound like...
Nice demonstration of the differences. And I should say, you know, Morten, like Joplin, composed his music. I've heard he even composed the solos for the people in his band.
Yeah, that's true. So, he was very peculiar of his music, too, but still looked at this as organized form of jazz, of course.
Well, I'd love to hear you both do some more music of Jelly Roll Morten, but first we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back with Vernell Bonnaries and Morten Gunnar Larsen with the music of Jelly Roll Morten. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Vanel Bonnerys and Morten Gunnar Larsen, and they're performing in New York at Michael's Pub in a review called Jelly Roll Morten, A Memorial. You know, Morten was demonstrating before the difference between, say, Scott Joplin and Jelly Roll Morten playing a rag. I think with Morten singing, there's something very kind of behind the beat about it. I wonder how you would characterize his singing, maybe as composed to other people who sang in the period.
Oh, it's very different from, for example, what you would think of in vaudeville. Like when I play Papa Do, they write on, it's practically a direct delivery from the sheet music. But he likes to lay back and taste it before delivering it. Like a cook would taste to see if there's enough salt in it before you put it out there. And I love his delivery. It has nothing to do with sheet music. So by listening to him for years and years, I was able to get myself to lay back. I don't know if I'm laying back exactly when he does, but it has that general quality to it.
Can I get you to do a couple of bars in the vaudeville style of that period to contrast it?
Yeah, hooey. Yes.
Hey, Gorkus may come.
Yeah, I just thought of that tune. Yeah, why don't we do that? Whatever key you want.
Yeah, is it B flat?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be fine.
Okay.
Cakewalkers may come, cakewalkers may go, but I want to tell you about a couple I know. They high-stepping gals and debonair. When it comes to business, not a soul can compare. Like that.
Oh, it's great, yeah.
Yeah, but it's right on it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I like them both.
Okay. That helps.
Yeah.
There is a recording of Bessie Smith doing that one, and she does it a lot slower and lays back,
right,
you know, like
right.
A jazz performer would do.
Vernell, has doing this Jelly Roll Morten show given you a different perspective at all on New Orleans, where you're from? You know, going back and listening to his stories of coming of age there? And
yes. It's a little frightening for me sometimes in the middle of the show because I look so much like this photograph that they have of Jelly Roll Morten on the wall. And
that's the truth. I mean, you really do look a lot like him.
It's incredible, particularly when I have on the...
the apparel.
Pimp. Yeah.
the
old pimp apparel. But there's a continuum for me that I feel in his stories, and hearing his accent is like hearing any uncle of mine talk. And so there's I feel like I'm carrying the flag on, or the fire like they do in the Olympics, you know, but I feel like I'm just passing it through. And it's sort of that feeling like when you buy a house and you look at the list of previous owners and you know you're going to be one on that list. It's not your house. You get to use it for that period and love it for that period. There's a mortality involved in all of this. But there's a continuum, too, so it's been nice.
In one of the things, at least one of the things that you do in the voice of Jelly Roll Morten, there's a reference to spells. And one of his pieces is Grandpa Spells.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or is it Grandma Spells?
Grandpa Spells,
yeah. Were you exposed to spells and that when you were in New Orleans?
Yeah, definitely. That's just part of the everyday life.
Because it always sounds so exotic to outsiders.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Was that through your grandmother?
No, that was through everybody. You do the little things, you know, like if somebody comes over and you don't particularly care for them to come back anymore, when they're leaving, you roll an onion behind them. you know, just things that there's a thousand and one varieties of little things that you can do to sort of assure that this happens for you.
What else would you do?
That I would do? I never rolled an onion, but...
you didn't? You never did any of that stuff?
Yeah, I like candles, and it's very mixed. You know, when you come from there, the Roman Catholic ritual is extremely mixed up with the old voodoo thing, so... and then so they call it white voodoo instead of black voodoo or something. But it's all so crazy and mixed up that you just colorfully go along your way.
Well, let's close with another song from the show. Do you know another song for us?
Yes.
Sweet Substitute.
That's a good one. She tells me that she's mine, all mine. Does anything I tell her, love is blind. She's got such loving ways, oh ways. Got my head in a daze. She's mighty cute, my new recruit, my sweet substitute. Don't want no regulars, my sweet substitute.
Beautiful. Thank you both so much for coming and performing for us. It's
really
been a delight. Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for coming. My guests have been Vernell Bonneries and Morten Gunnar Larsen, who are performing in a Jelly Roll Morton review called Jelly Roll Morton, A Memorial, and it was written and directed by Vernell. And it will be performed through December 2nd at Michael's Pub in New York. When I say written by Vernell, I mean it's the words of Jelly Roll Morton, but Vernell put it together and chose which of Jelly Roll Morton's words to use. All right. Well, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Morton, would you play us out with some Jelly Roll Morton's music?
Yeah, could do the Pearls, for instance.
Great.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, comic actress Catherine O'Hara. She got her start understudying Gilda Radner at Toronto's Second City Theatre. Then she co-founded SCTV. Her characterizations of Katharine Hepburn, Brooke Shields, and Meryl Streep have been called eerily precise. Her own creation, Lola Heatherton, paid tribute to showbiz shallow minds and vast egos. More recently, O'Hara played the mother in Home Alone. Now she's back in Home Alone 2. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews an ABC miniseries about Michael Jackson and his family. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President-elect Bill Clinton held his first news conference today since winning last week's election. And he made it clear that he is intent on carrying out the main promise of his campaign to get the U.S. economy moving again. NPR's Mara Liasson reports from Little Rock.
Clinton made no cabinet-level appointments today, but he did announce more appointments to his transition team. The vast majority had been campaign staff. George Stephanopoulos, for instance, will maintain a similar role, running transition communications. But Clinton added two of his outside advisors to the transition team staff. To head domestic policy, he chose Al Fromm, the head of the Democratic Leadership Council, which represents the moderate to conservative wing of the party. And he chose Harvard professor Robert Reich, who is more liberal, to run the economic policy department. Although he received only 43% of the vote in last week's election, Clinton said today there was no question he had received a clear mandate. He said the American people had given him a mandate to end politics as usual and break the gridlock in Washington. Just as George Bush did in his inaugural address 4 years ago, Clinton said he would hold out a hand of cooperation to Republicans in Washington. In Little Rock, Arkansas, I'm Mara Liasson.
A naval officer who was discharged because he stated publicly that he was gay has returned to his old job. A federal court ordered the Navy to reinstate Chief Petty Officer Keith Meinhold, pending the outcome of his lawsuit challenging a U.S. military ban on homosexuals. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports from Los Angeles.
This morning, Chief Petty Officer Keith Meinhold became the first openly gay person to return to active service in the armed forces. He met briefly with reporters before entering the gate of Moffett Naval Air Station in Northern California. While admitting he was nervous about returning to duty, he said, "I expect the Navy to conduct itself in a professional manner. I'm sure it will be back to status quo." Meinhold first attempted to resume his former post on Monday after a federal judge ordered the Navy to reinstate him. But the officers at the base said they did not have permission from Washington to do that. The judge then said the Navy would face charges of contempt of court if they did not take Meinhold back, and said he was ordering the reinstatement based on the likelihood that Meinhold would successfully prove his case that the Pentagon's ban of homosexuals is unconstitutional. President-elect Bill Clinton has said he intends to lift that ban. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
The Postal Service and the U.S. Treasury have agreed on terms of refinancing postal debt to cut interest expenses. About $4.5 billion was refinanced in a move expected to cut interest rates by $2 billion over 20 years' time. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down less than 1 point to close at 3,239.79 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. A new ceasefire in Bosnia appears to be holding today, despite the fact that all sides have accused the others of a number of repeated violations in the center and eastern part of the nation. Around the capital city of Sarajevo, only small arms fire has been reported, but some serious violations have been reported in other areas. Peacekeeping officials have expressed the hope that a ceasefire might allow progress to be made in international peace talks now underway in Geneva. However, one official said a ceasefire cannot hold if there is no serious change in hearts and minds. All previous ceasefires have been broken. Tension between Islamic fundamentalists and Israel continued today. An Israeli soldier and a UN soldier were both killed in separate clashes. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israel television reported that there are now more troops and armor in the area of South Lebanon, Israel calls its security zone, than at any time since the Lebanese war 10 years ago. Reports from Lebanon say Hezbollah fighters have gone underground in anticipation of a large-scale Israeli ground invasion. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin would not comment on whether Israel is preparing an invasion of Lebanon, but he said that Israel would ensure the tranquility of the northern border. There were several clashes today in South Lebanon. A Nepalese UN soldier was killed and three other UN soldiers injured when Hezbollah attacked three UN positions. And an Israeli soldier was killed and two other Israeli soldiers injured in a Hezbollah attack on an Israeli position in the security zone. It seems unclear if either Israel or Hezbollah will back down. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The government says that the number of people filing new claims for unemployment benefits dropped by 5,000 in the latest reporting week. The Labor Department says that first-time applications for unemployment insurance came to 355,000 during the week ending October 31st. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The sequel to the third highest-grossing film of all time opens next week. The new film, Home Alone 2, features the now-famous child actor Macaulay Culkin, and my guest Catherine O'Hara returns in the role of the mother. Many of us know O'Hara best from her years with SCTV, the TV sketch comedy show that spoofed television.
Her most memorable original character on the show was Lola Heatherton, a temperamental and talentless singer. Several of O'Hara's SCTV co-stars have also gone on to film careers, like John Candy, Martin Short, and Rick Moranis. In Home Alone, O'Hara took her big, noisy family on a Christmas trip to Paris. She knew she forgot something. Turns out she forgot her son, Kevin. The family sets off on another trip in the sequel and, of course, manages to lose Kevin again.
We get him to the airport this time, but he's tagging along behind the whole family running. And we're running again, of course. We're late. And he's following his father, who's wearing a camel coat and has, you know, the hair of John Hurt, which is on his head. And another man who looks just like John Hurt from behind with the same coat crosses paths with John Hurt. And he follows that man instead onto a plane to New York.
How has Macaulay Culkin changed? Has he become this big spoiled child star now?
He's the demon child now. No, he's sweet. He's the same kid. The people around him, not his, you know, immediate family and the people who are supposed to be around him, but, you know, fans and visitors to the sets have they're different. You know, he's got this giant aura of success, and people want to touch him.
I'm interested in hearing how you became a performer. Were you a performing kind of kid, the kind of kid who always wanted to do showbiz?
I guess. I think, actually, you know, coming from a big family and coming from parents who are really funny, I think, on their own, it was really kind of a natural way of thinking and talking in our home, you know, just sort of trying to make each other laugh. And it was the best way to get attention at the dinner table.
Now, you grew up in Toronto, or just outside of Toronto,
Yes. But
you, I believe, got started in Second City, Chicago.
No, actually, I was in Second City, Toronto.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they opened it about 10 or 15 years after the other one opened, I guess, in 1973. And John Candy was putting the first Toronto touring company together, and he hired myself and my brother Marcus and Peter Aykroyd, Dan Aykroyd's younger brother, and a bunch of other people. We got the touring company, and then Joe Flaherty was directing the main company, and the two women in the main company were Rosemary Radcliffe and Gilda Radner. And so he asked me to understudy them. And then maybe 3-4 months later, Gilda decided to leave and go to National Lampoon Touring Company out of New York. And so I went with the cast to understudy for the first 2 weeks, and then in the third week I took over for Gilda, and she went to do National Lampoon.
So you got hired as an understudy for Gilda Radner.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, when you're understudying Gilda Radner, were you expected to do her characters if she got sick, or would the sketches change and you would do your own characters?
Oh, no, you fit into the show and you know, I started basically imitating her. So I even got a perm to look like her.
Really?
Yeah.
So what characters was she doing that you had to do?
Actually, I would say maybe in that show it was an early version of her Emily Letella. I think that's the woman that would say never mind, you know, she'd, mm-hmm. on the news on Saturday Night Live, because she was doing an interview. This is one scene I remember, an interview scene with John Candy interviewing, and she was talking about her shoes, being able to talk to her, and she was just sort of this sweet old lady, and you had to believe what she said because she was so convincing. And I would, you know, dare to take her place. And when I did take her place, actually replace her in Chicago, the producer and director at the time, Bernie Solins, I look back on it now and I realize he must have really missed her. And it was like a man who'd lost his wife and had a new girlfriend and wanted the new girlfriend to be like the wife. Because he just said, no, no, Gilda did it like this. No, Gilda looked at him like this. No, say it like Gilda. Do it like Gilda. And I was like weeping by the end of the day thinking, I'm not Gilda. What does he want from me? Let me be myself. But I had to. That's the way it is at Second City, because you do fit into a show. You have to start by imitating the person you're, you know, as not to disrupt the show and throw the other people off. You have to fit in as easily as you can, you know, and then you find your way.
Catherine O'Hara is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Catherine O'Hara, and she's She starred in Home Alone, and she's starring in the sequel, which is about to open. And you probably also know her from earlier film roles and also from her years on SCTV. Let me ask you about some of the characters you created for SCTV. Can we start with Lola Heatherton?
Yeah.
She was a real, like, showbiz singer, somewhere between a has-been and a never-was.
Oh, I love playing kind of cocky, untalented people.
Yeah.
It was fun.
So did the Heatherton come from Joey Heatherton?
They'd done Sammy Maudlin's show a few times on the show, and I'd only gone on a couple of times as a character that didn't fit in, like this. I did a Trish Nutley thing, which is supposed to be like a starlet, and I went on, and I didn't understand, you know, the game, and they were all real, you know, insincere and show busy, and I didn't fit in. So I didn't have a character that was sort of one of them, you know. And then we were asked to do the Junos or something. No, not the Junos. The Nellies. The Canadian Television Awards. We were asked to do it live. And Joe Flaherty and the others wanted to do a Sammy Maudlin show. And I had to get a character for the show that was like them, right? A sleazy kind of has-been Vegas character. And I think the night before we started writing it, I saw Lola Falana on The Tonight Show. And she was singing Sometimes When We Touch. And she was making her bottom lip quiver. And she was really crinkling up her eyes, trying to get some tears going. So by the end, she was crying. But I thought, well, there's a thing to use. I'll use that. And I'd also just always been fascinated with Joey Heatherton from those Be a Perfect Sleeper, Buy a Perfect Lucerta ads. Mm-hmm. It's the only thing I'd ever seen her in. But I liked her look. And so I went with her blonde hair and her look and the Lola Falana kind of tear thing whenever I could. And otherwise, it wasn't based on anyone. I took their two names, you know, Lola Heatherton.
Yeah. Now, you had male dancers sometimes, too, didn't you?
Yeah. Jewel Hallmeyer was our costume designer on the show, and I was doing a Lola special once, and we needed dancers. And I think they'd already done maybe one other, you know, fictitious special on the show where they had danced. But for my show, we called them the Jewel Hallmeyer dancers, and they became the Jewel Hallmeyer. And then it was great. Like, Jewel said he got, you know, phone calls to do, like, shows on his own with the dancers. And it was him. You know, he's a wardrobe designer. And then there was a grip, and then there were a few of the writers, Bob Dolman and Doug Steckler and a few other writers on the show. And it was so funny because they would really rehearse and try to get it right, and that just only made it better, you know, because they could never get it quite right.
Now, you used to do Meryl Streep, and this was the period when Streep was famous for developing her characters through accents, in a way.
Yeah.
You had acted in a movie with her in Heartburn in 1986, but
that was much later, yeah.
Yeah, so you were doing her before you were with her.
But I only did her once, and that was Big Jim and Billy Saul Hurock, or whatever they were called. Joe and John had these kind of country bumpkin characters who had a showbiz talk show, and then they would bring on guests just to blow them up. And usually it was people they didn't like. You know, they would sort of get people in show business by having them on the show and blowing them up. But I think at the time, Meryl Streep had done a lot of movies where she was crying a lot, and they just wanted me to go on and start crying and then blow me up. This is so stupid. I can't explain it. They wrote it. Don't blame me. But that was always the case with any impersonation. I would, you know, I'd write something or somebody else would write something, and then you would just have to get that impersonation. You'd try to get it together as well as you could just for that scene, and then it would be gone. And when I did try to do Meryl Streep in that scene, I had about five lines, and maybe two of them sounded like her, and the other three didn't. You know, so she was not somebody I did regularly.
Now, what about Katharine Hepburn, your version of her?
Yeah, I that's the same sort of thing where I think the first time I did it, Dave Thomas and Rick Moranis had written a scene for her, for her to be in. And so then I just went and watched a couple of tapes, and she was supposed to be as herself, you know. So you were really lucky if whoever you were supposed to impersonate had recently done something, you know, for television, or you'd get a tape of it, you know. And I got a tape of her and Dick Cavett, which was her being herself, and I just sort of watched that a few times, and then I sat in a room by myself and tried to wreck my voice, basically, and I just would go, until I basically wrecked my voice, and then I would do her. But I only did her a couple of times on the show, and each time I had to, you know, really work on it for, you know, a half hour or whatever beforehand.
You left SCTV in 1983 after around 7 years.
I think I actually left earlier.
Oh, okay.
I left in, maybe 81 or 82 I left it. Oh, big deal, huh? Like, I can remember.
What was it like when you left? What kind of offers were you hoping for? What happened to your career in the next couple of years?
I'll tell you what I was really hoping for when I left was just dating. I was hoping to get offers of dates because I had no personal life.
it finally dawned on me when I was doing SCTV, and it was, though it was just so exciting and great, and, you know, I have nothing but fond memories of those days. I got to be like 25, I guess, or something around there, mid-20s, and you know, my oldest sister got married at 23, and my next oldest sister got married at 21, and then my next oldest sister got engaged at 21, but didn't get married. But I saw myself, you know, when I was younger, as being married and having kids by the time I was 25, and here I was on this show, and I was really having fun with these people, but most of them went home to families, and, you know, I went home to myself, and it just, it finally dawned on me that I had, you know, sort of neglected my personal life, because I'd fallen into the career, and it was great, and I took advantage of it. But then I thought, no, I also have to take care of that other side of life. So I quit mainly to get a personal life together, and then eventually to, you know, try to get into film.
But, you know, when you quit to get a personal life, you can't very well have your agent put out, you know, put out the word, no. Catherine O'Hara is now available for dating and marriage.
No, you just sort of have more free hours.
So did you meet people?
Yeah, I did, eventually. But it's funny, then I dated for a few years, and I would go audition, you know, I was living in Toronto, and I would fly to New York or L.A. to audition for things, and, you know, I did odd jobs, but nothing really great, and although I got After Hours, and then I got Heartburn, that was pretty nice, but, you know, they were sort of over a span of a few years. And then I was going through this really kind of bad, I guess it's the closest I've ever been to any kind of breakdown, although it wasn't that extreme, but I was very depressed and I was alone. And I bought a house in Toronto, which I never thought I'd have to do on my own. I'd figure that's the kind of thing you do with a husband. But I bought it with my mom. I mean, I bought it money-wise, but my mom helped me buy it. So then I was just sort of alone in this house and got real depressed, and I was hanging around my best friend Robin. And months before, I'd been called about auditioning for Beetlejuice, this movie that this guy Tim Burton was going to do. So then I was going through this depression, like months later, in Toronto, thinking, what am I doing in my life? And, oh, I'm alone and all. Although I did have my family, and I was very lucky to have my family in Toronto. But anyway, I went through this, self-centered depression. And the next morning, after this peak of depression, or ebb, whatever you call it, my agent called, and she said, remember that guy Tim Burton in that movie Beetlejuice? Well, now they want to offer it to you. And I thought, oh, maybe this is a sign from God to get out of the house, meet people, do something, be productive. So I went and did it, and I also, you know, this started with the dating idea. I actually met the guy that I married this year.
Oh, doing Beetlejuice.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Isn't that a cute story? I'm sorry. I do go on.
You know, it's a nice story.
Yeah.
So is your husband in show business, too?
Yeah, I met him on the movie. He's a production designer.
Mm-hmm.
His name's Bo Welch. He designed Beetlejuice. He designed Lost Boys was his first movie. He did Batman Returns, Accidental Tourist, Grand Canyon, and now he's doing a movie with Mike Nichols that Jack Nicholson's going to star in.
Hmm.
He's very talented.
What would you most like to be doing, though, in the movies?
In the movies?
Yeah, or on television.
Eventually, I would love to write screenplays and direct them
mm-hmm.
with my friends
mm-hmm.
as the stars.
That reminds me, one of our producers was telling me earlier today about a video that you did that was shown on David Letterman a few years ago
yeah.
about PMS.
Yeah.
I missed it, but maybe you could tell me something about it.
Well, they have they did it for 2 or 3 years, and this was the first year. They had a Thanksgiving film festival on the David Letterman show, and they would invite people to make their own film, and they gave us a budget of, I think, $10,000 or $15,000, and they had, on the first show, they had Michael Keaton, he did one, and Bette Midler did one, and Paul Schaefer did one, and they asked Andrea and I, and at first we were like, hey, why don't they, let's each do one, but we got into the idea of doing it together, and the idea was that you take this money, you do whatever you want, you spend it, you know, whatever way you want, and or pocket it in the whatever way you want, and then present it on the show. We had to go on the show and talk about the making of it and then show the film. And so we were coming up, Andrea and I were getting together every day and trying to come up with ideas, and we came up with a lot of silly ideas. And then I was in such a bad mood. I was going through PMS at the time, and it finally hit me that that's what I was going through. And I said, why don't we write about something important, like what I'm going through right now? And she'd been through it, too, most months. So we developed this silly little film about two women who make a film about PMS, but they're going through PMS while they're making the film. So
everything's sort of twisted about this little film. And they have little segments where they interview people and where they have, you know, dramatic, you know, simulations of women, you know, in relationships with PMS. And then it would cut back to them doing little introductions to these segments. And every time you saw them, they were either, you know, having a fist fight or crying or, you know. And the whole show by the end didn't make any sense because, you know, because of what they were going through. And both Andrea and I have talked about this so many times. Both of us have had more recognition from that film than anything else either of us have done.
Really?
Both of us have had so many, especially men, come up to us in the last, like still, like last week I had somebody come up to me and say this, that they didn't believe that their wife or girlfriend, you know, who claimed to be, you know, experiencing PMS, they didn't believe them until they saw this. We'd actually convinced men that PMS existed.
See, this is why I would never vote for a woman president.
Oh, get out of here. Oh, you mean that's what they would say?
No.
Thanks. Oh, all the more reason to. I'd say men are, you know, when I'm going through PMS, that's what men are like all the time. That's a constant sort of, that's normal for guys.
Actress Catherine O'Hara, she co-stars in Home Alone 2, which opens next week. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have on President-elect Bill Clinton's first press conference since the election?
Well, the President-elect said that he intends to proceed with job creation plans once he's inaugurated. He said that Vernon Jordan, his transition chief's presence on a tobacco company board, is no problem because Mr. Jordan will not be selecting health officials in his role as head of the transition. He also fleshed out more of the staff of that transition. We'll be hearing about all that from Mara Liasson. We'll also hear from Colonel David Hackworth and why he disagrees with President Bill Clinton about relaxing the ban on homosexuals in the military, and a program in Los Angeles that rewards kids who excel by giving rent breaks to their parents.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This weekend, ABC presents the first installment of a 5-hour miniseries called The Jacksons, An American Dream. It's an authorized biography of Michael Jackson and his family. TV critic David Bianculli says if you're excited by the prospect of watching this series, don't be.
There are so many things that bother me about this Jackson's miniseries that I don't know where to start. Yeah, I do. It's the moment when all the Jackson brothers are goofing around playing basketball, and their domineering father, Joe, played by Lawrence Hilton Jacobs, comes outside and yells at them.
Time for rehearsals. Hey, let's go. Let's go.
Sure. I don't feel good.
You know, the Osmonds don't always feel good either. But they don't let it stop them. That's why they're on the radio. Always. Day and night. Come on.
Now think about that, because it's one of the only moments in this 5-hour drama that puts the Jackson 5 in its proper perspective. Yes, the Jackson 5 produced a lot of hits, but the main thing it did was give Michael Jackson room to grow, and to outgrow them. Otherwise, the Jacksons were a lot like the Osmonds, successful, but dismissed as bubblegum by a lot of their peers. This miniseries wants to be fair and spread the focus around, but that only makes things even duller. It's a full half hour before the first of the Jackson kids is even born. And after 5 hours of drama, the only other Jackson sibling besides Michael to make any kind of an impact is Jermaine. Worst of all, perhaps, is that the girls, Rebby, LaToya, and Janet, are almost totally ignored. But in the case of LaToya, we all know why that is. The Jacksons, An American Dream is produced by the real Jermaine Jackson and his wife, Margaret Maldonado Jackson. So, just like the recent Sinatra miniseries, which was produced by Frank's daughter Tina, it's an inside job, which means it reveals some things, but not too much. For instance, it acknowledges that Joe Jackson occasionally beat his kids and cheated on his wife, but doesn't emphasize it. It mentions sibling rivalry once, but never dramatizes it, and so on. The worst thing is what it leaves out. There are at least 3 times where this miniseries cuts to a commercial, then returns with all the characters 5 or 6 years older. And that includes the most crucial time frame of all, the period leading up to Michael Jackson's Off the Wall and Thriller albums. And even when the drama introduces an idea, it seldom follows it up. It spends a lot of time showing young Michael playing with and talking to a pet rat that he tamed at night in his family's kitchen, until his father set a trap and killed it. That seems to be a perfect scene to set up Jackson's recording of Ben, his love story to a rat that became a hit from the movie Willard, except that Ben is never mentioned. And neither is Jackson's extensive plastic surgery, even though we do get this scene, where Michael, played as a teenager by Jason Weaver, confides to his mother, played by Angela Bassett.
You know, my nose is too wide. Fans expect me to sign and look another way, like I did when I was little.
You just gotta be who you are, Michael.
I don't know who I am. Except music. Music is in me. That's all I remember in my life is music. My album's not doing anything. My voice has changed. You know what they say right in front of me? That's little Michael Jackson. Yuck. He's got pimples.
On the creative side, there's no examination of what inspired the songs. Not even the love child claims that prompted Michael to write Billie Jean. On the business side, there's no mention of his record company's fights with MTV. No look at the making of his videos. No one playing producer Quincy Jones or promoter Don King. And the finale, which takes place during the Jacksons' victory tour in 1984, tries to stage a triumph where there wasn't one. This miniseries is no triumph either. All it does is provide proof that the story really worth telling and worth watching has yet to be made. And that's the Michael Jackson story.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Voblaitis, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Schirach directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Swoon. We talk with director Tom Kalin about his new film, which explores the lives of the so-called thrill killers, Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb. Also, Dracula, the new film and the classic book. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.